The book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome to the program today Paul Tremblay. He joins us on the telephone in Massachusetts. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Vic. How you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Much better now, Paul, that we've tracked you down. You're very elusive.
I am elusive. Nothing else.
You have a new book out. It's a collection of stories called Growing Things. Is this your first collection of short stories?
It is not, but it is my first with, a major publisher.
Oh.
I got my start writing in the smaller independent presses, so I actually had two other prior collections. But again, one was with, both were with presses that maybe sold, a couple hundred copies kind of thing.
So now they're really collectible.
That's right. I suppose those are really collectible.
Well, I have a confession to make, Paul. This is the first book of yours that I have read, and so bear that in mind as we're talking, because I know reading some of these stories, I was missing some references to some of your previous work. I'm positive of that.
Mm. That's okay. I mean, the hope was, I wanted to try to serve two kinds of readers, people who have never read me before, and, for those who might have read some of the novels, there were a couple of references, but, my hope was that it would work for anybody who, who would read the collection. And ultimately, it's only maybe three or four stories out of the 19 that actually have connections to the prior novels.
Okay. All right, let's talk about the first story, which is your title story, Growing Things. I understand that you were out walking your dog and you got an inspiration.
Yeah, sort of twofold. So I was out walking my dog, as I do, because I'm still a high school teacher by day, so I have the summers off. I was walking along, there's still a few dirt roads where I live, so I like to take the dog down by there. I noticed one day at the side of the road, there were almost like ankle-high, a sprouting of ankle-high weeds that went all along like the length of that dirt road. But then every day I went by, they grew almost like doubled in size to the point where it almost felt like within a week or 10 days, these things were as tall as I was, which was, and I'm 6'4". So that got me to thinking, okay, what would happen if, I guess a kudzu question, but a little bit more horrific. Mm-hmm. What would happen if these things were to continue to grow and grow? And that was just like one of those little what ifs that I feel like most writers are looking for when they're just going about their day.
Paul, you just used the term horrific, and I guess some of our listeners are probably tuning in on that reference. I know I am, because it's sort of an indication of where we're going here. Would you describe your current work as being in the horror genre? I know that's kind of a loaded question.
Sure. No, definitely. As loaded as the answer, I suppose, could be. And I will admit I've struggled with sort of the loadedness of genre for a while, even as recent as a few years ago, when I would be at mainstream literary conventions, when I was introduced and asked what I wrote, I would sometimes say I wrote literary horror, to maybe try to take that sting out of it a little for some people.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like in the past few years, I've just fully come to embrace it. I mean, I will fully admit that, if I do have an agenda in general with everything I do, it's that I do want horror to be taken more seriously. And I think it is now, but I still think it sort of has a ways to go. I think there's a lot of reasons as to why people don't take it seriously, and sometimes it's, I think, well-founded. But I don't know. I'm very excited to be working in horror today, because I think there are so many different filmmakers and writers that are just doing some really wonderful, high-minded stuff with horror at times, for a lack of a better phrase.
Do you feel it's a genre that just isn't accorded the respect of other genres?
I do. I mean, it's probably... I think it's getting better. I mean, better than it used to be, but, I don't know if we're going to stack genres around. I mean, perhaps the only other genre that I think that mainstream readers maybe think, worse of or lower of is romance. I think both horror and romance, a lot of people have low opinions of, or I would never read that kind of thing. You know, which is funny because for me that's so hard to understand at times because I'm almost like the total opposite direction. That horror has been a part of my fandom, a part of my life for as long as I can remember. I almost have a hard time understanding the other point of view. Like I have a hard time understanding why aren't you excited by this or intrigued or you know or a fan. Yeah, I don't know. I'm stumbling around there because it is such a loaded question of genre.
Yeah,
I think the main reason why, like if we boil, like horror sort of depends on a transgression, right? And if that goes poorly, like if it's done poorly, I mean, I think that just leaves like a lasting mark on the viewer or the reader. you know, and I do think there are so many examples, particularly in mainstream Hollywood of, you know, horror that's misogynistic or homophobic, you know, et cetera. But to me, my favorite horror stories are the ones that ask the hardest questions. Like if a horror story is the reveal of a terrible truth, my favorite stories sort of tackle that, you know, head on and then ask the questions like, well, how are these characters what are they going to do now? What decisions are they going to make? How did they live through this? How does anybody live through this? I don't know. I think those are like the hardest questions that art and literature can answer. And I think horror can get at it in really interesting ways.
My guest is Paul Tremblay. His book is Growing Things. It's a collection of stories, and it was just published. And he joins us on the telephone in Massachusetts. Do you ever get letters addressed to Mr. Ambiguous Horror?
Maybe I will now.
Yeah.
I don't get very many actual letters anymore, but certainly emails and you know tweets and whatnot. I mean, my editor certainly does. So I suppose you're referencing... What was said in the story Notes from the Dog Walkers?
My favorite story. It's more of a novella, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you very much. Yes, it is. And I guess for your listeners, it was a fun story to write because it sort of starts off with a fun, quirky conceit that this is the novella is told from notes left from dog walkers, like literal notes that these people who are walking the dog of an author who may or may not be me, sort of tells this wildly metafictional story.
Yeah. The thing I liked about that story is it's funny.
Well, thank you.
I need humor in my stuff. I'm sorry about that, but I just... there's so much humor laced through that, yet it's also very serious, and you're having this fun time of looking in the mirror and seeing there's another mirror, and then there's another mirror. And right. When you have this dog walker who starts going through the books and giving critiques on the writer. Oh, that's just hysterical.
Well, thank you. Well, it's funny. I mean, I think, you know, horror and humor are so closely related. Honestly, to me, they're like two sides of a coin. You know, when we go through our daily lives, when we're confronted with, you know, sort of the absurdity of everydayness, I don't know. There's like one of two reactions you can have. You can react in horror or you can, you know, sort of laugh. Right. And actually, the two sort of parts of my career, my first few novels that were published in the late, you know, 2010s, or sorry, the late 2000s, excuse me, were, you know, humorous detective novels. And I wrote like one sort of satirical science fiction novel. So it was funny. For a while, all my short stories that I wrote were horror and all the longer pieces that I wrote were humor. But to me, they sort of felt like, you know, the same. I felt like I was working sort of like the same style, just maybe like a slightly different approach. So I mean, I'm glad that you found humor in that story, and I'm actually sort of itching to do a little bit more humorous stuff, you know, going forward.
Did you feel like maybe those crime novels, you were kind of getting off on the wrong foot? What made you decide to go away from that?
Well, when I first started writing, I was like, all right, I'm a horror writer. This is what I do. I mean, this is when I was just messing around with writing stories.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like it was an important part of my development it wasn't like a one-day realization, but I felt like it was a slow realization. When I started getting other types of ideas, I thought to myself, okay, maybe I'm a writer who sometimes writes horror. And what that meant to me was I wouldn't try to force a story idea into something that it wasn't. I would just, you know, let the story be what it was, you know, which is easier said than done. But that's really sort of like how I try to approach everything that I write, that everything must serve the story. There's no fluff. I have to be able to explain, at least to myself, why something is in a particular story. So, you know, I just happen to have, like, this crazy detective story idea about a narcoleptic private detective in South Boston.
A narcoleptic, really?
Yeah.
So he falls asleep at the wrong times?
Yep. Falls. And when I actually did some research into narcolepsy, because I think that's what most people just assume, that's sort of the extent of it.
Uh-huh.
But for people who have like the worst shades of narcolepsy, they'll fall directly into the dream state. So they'll have like these really vivid hallucinations, or they're called hypnagogic hallucinations. And they'll have a hard time discerning, was that real or was that a dream? So, you know, I got to play with that in my two books.
Wow. I need to look.
Yeah, they were fun books. For a variety of reasons, they didn't do well. I think some of it was timing. Some of it, the publisher was really going through a tough time, like a new publisher for the actual publisher itself was being hired. Like my editor left.
Mm-hmm.
All things not good for a first-time novelist.
An imperfect
story.
It
hasn't been announced publicly yet, so maybe I'll mention it on your waves for the first time, is that my current publisher is planning on reissuing the two crime novels.
Oh, cool.
You know, maybe about a year, year and a half.
Those were originally on Holt?
Yes, they were originally with Henry Holt.
Well, I'm going to watch out for those, because this narcolepsy thing, you got me hooked. I'm kind of I'm a crime fiction nut. In fact, your story, 19 Snapshots of Dennis Port, there's definitely some noir, crimey elements going on there. What a fun story. Now, this goes back to your memories of summer vacations.
Yes, definitely. I'm glad you brought that story up, too. That's one of my personal favorites. And actually, that story was commissioned when I was sort of being debuted as a crime writer. It was written for – there's a wonderful series of books that a press in New York called Akashic Books. They put out
uh-huh.
noir books for, like, cities all around the country and all around the world. You know, there's, like, Boston Noir, L.A. Noir. So this one just happened to be Cape Cod Noir. And, yeah, so the story called 19 Snapshots of Dennis Port, I essentially wrote about – I fictionalized a family vacation that I had a long time ago,
mm-hmm.
Much to my father's chagrin. My father is a very good man, and he – in the story, the father, something not so good happens.
Yeah.
But the conceit was also fun because the story, the title of the story, 19 Snapshots of Dennis Port, the story is told through these 19 Polaroid photographs. There's 19 photographs. What's on them is sort of described, and then the narrator sort of adds to the scene of the photograph, like what was actually going on.
Uh-huh. I like that. You use all these different techniques in these stories, and that was a really fun one because they really are snapshots. They're quick. They're pithy.
Well, thank you.
Yeah,
I think with short fiction especially, I definitely lean towards, if not experimentation, but I don't know. I like new toys, so I like the idea of playing around with different ways to present, fiction. I think that can work a little bit better in short stories because maybe the reader has a little bit more patience to try reading something that's not in a traditional narrative mode.
Mm-hmm.
So the Dog Walker Notes. We've got the photographs, there's another story in the collection that is essentially like a found diary with footnotes and stuff like that. I don't know. For me, that's just kind of fun. I try not to do that as like a gimmick. I try to make sure that if there is something unusual to the narrative structure, it has to serve the story in some way.
I found myself wishing that one you wrote in longhand, we could have seen the longhand version of it.
Yeah. I know. I actually wrote it in longhand. I think I mentioned in my notes that,
uh-huh.
as you just referenced, I wrote it in longhand first. So that novel, that story, it's called Notes from the Barn in the Wild, was written for a different anthology. And I actually asked them, hey, I wrote this in longhand. There's the way that we could present this longhand. And I don't know, I think design-wise, it was just too difficult
mm-hmm.
to shrink it down, to a book size so that it could be easily read. But no, I agree. I kind of wish it would still be in that format.
Because the footnotes are cool, but we know that it looked different before. Stuff was written on the sides, marginalia, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny. So the publisher, it's called Word Horde Press. It's probably one of my favorite sort of smaller independent horror presses. So when they published this anthology, it's called The Children of Old Leech. My story was just one of like 20 other authors. But what they did for the first 100 people who ordered the book, they actually took my handwritten notes and printed it as like a giant, they printed it as basically a little mini notebook, and they actually published 100 of those for the first 100 people who did the anthology, and that was really cool.
Mm.
It's just too bad I couldn't replicate that for the collection.
Another one of my favorites in here is the one where, I'm sorry, I don't know the title. I know I'm supposed to know it, but I'm not that smart.
That's quite right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Sorry.
The blank line.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. The one that's basically untitled.
Right, right. Yeah. But there is a title. We're supposed to figure it out, right?
Yeah, or yeah, right. Or it could be a reference to there's a strange character in the story who's, you know, I guess unnamed. So I'm kind of thinking, you know, potentially that represents, you know, the sort of the blankness of that character.
Okay. Maybe. That is a cute story.
Thank you.
You have fun with this father who's sitting there watching the kids have swimming lessons. You really have a good time with that. And I was trying to picture how you imagined that story. If you were imagining yourself going through this encounter, how did this come to you?
Yeah, I think so many of my stories, I do usually start off, you know, if it's not me in the story, it's maybe like a jumping off point. You know, because I think all these stories are full of both truths and lies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so this one in particular did start off as me because, you know, I teach, as I mentioned earlier, I'm a high school teacher. I have summers off. My wife works full time. So most of the summers when my kids were younger, you know, it was me taking them to our local pond to get their swimming lessons. And even now, you know, in 2010, 11, 12, you know, even then, like, you know, I was pretty much the only, you know, father at the beach, everyone else's moms, you know, because it's, you know, during the morning or early afternoon while, you know, so many of us are still, other people are still working. Yeah, so part of that was just like, oh, the anxiety of like, yeah, I'm the only guy here. And again, just like the what ifs start percolating. And I thought that was an interesting, uncomfortable beginning to the story, which I don't mind giving away. So there's a father with his two kids at the pond swimming lessons, and then a woman comes to the beach who isn't his wife but pretends that she's his wife, and he sort of plays along for whatever reason.
Yeah, it's kind of a fantasy sequence, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Fantasy that quickly goes bad.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I love the reaction of his kids when they come back to the car. It's really, really funny and kind of weird and creepy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to circle back to Notes from the Dog Walkers because I just love this story so much. And you have a line in here I like to read that just really, really hit me like a hammer.
Okay.
And you write, or I should say one of the dog walkers writes, in writing to this writer, supposedly, if this is actually being written, it's hard enough to write something for readers who are, you know, actually breathing and buying books now without putting undue pressure on yourself to write something that will be read by people 50 years from now, assuming there will be anyone left alive in 50 years or five, or even if our melting, flooding, smoking cinder has flea-like mutant people scratching around, who's to say their Skynet overlords will allow them to read anything?
That's a mouthful.
Oh, I love that.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Let's laugh. Let's laugh as we go plummeting. Yeah, brilliant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so I think that's a mix of both, you know, horror and humor, right? Sort of like the two sides of the coin.
Right. Our Skynet overlords. Yeah, I like that. You're taking it into the world of sci-fi, which you also like.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it's also a reflection of like all the pop cultural reference I've used. You know, particularly there's a few novels that I wrote, A Head Full of Ghosts being the main culprit, where I definitely sort of roll around and use, you know, references to pop culture to, you know, not only add to the story, but maybe even add to the ambiguity, because it feels like this is real once you reference something that you recognize, right?
Mm-hmm.
But maybe it isn't real because, you know, you're referencing this and, you know, they sort of look too good to be true kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, so part of the Notes from the Dog Walker was sort of letting loose a little bit my writer's id to, you know, at times maybe argue about things like the idea of deathless prose, which for some reason, I think within genre communities, that's like a big concern. I don't know, particularly in horror where there's a subset of writers who like to write maybe sort of older style ghost stories. And, you know, they worry about, oh, you can't put, or I've even heard YA authors talk about this, which is, you know, crazy to me. Like when they talk about how you can't put like references to text or tweets into your stories because it'll date them, and then people, when they read them later, you know, either they'll laugh at it because it's so out of date, or you know, they won't know what was going on.
Yeah, like, why do you have a telegraph in here?
Right, which is just strikes me so silly.
Right.
Because, like, where is the cutoff in our timeline for Deathless Prose? Right? Is it, you know, is it in 1989, when cable was kind of out, but before cell phones? Is it in, you know, the 50s before we get certain kinds of cars? I don't know. To go back to what I said earlier, I'm all about, you know, putting everything into the story that you can, as long as it serves a story, right? If you need texts to tell the story, then use them. If you need to mention Twitter because this is what's, you know, going on in your story, then you have to mention it. As long as it isn't there just to be like, you know, window dressing, it has to serve the story.
Yeah.
So I think, like I said, that, like that sort of crazy dog walker note that you just read, you know, it's hard enough trying to, you know, write a story that's going to communicate to people now, never mind trying to communicate with, you know, people in, you know, some unseen future.
Well, Paul, I'm glad you mentioned Twitter, because I have found in this world that we're living in that social media can be a time gobbler. I restrict myself to Twitter. I don't look at Facebook. I don't look at anything else, any of those other ones, Instagram, Snapchat, none of those. Twitter's my little refuge that I hide in occasionally, and I do see you. I saw you were on there today. You were giving some guy a hard time who was looking for a blurb. I thought that was pretty funny. I'm sure he's not listening right now, or this person is not listening right now. Tell us about right. the aggravation and annoyance that you endure.
Sure. I mean, and I never named the guy, so I want to be clear. I wasn't totally mean. It was presented more as like, hey, don't act like this person. You know, so someone had asked me for like a blurb, you know, to read the book, to put a quote on the back of it over a year and a half ago. And I get asked a lot. I'm in a very cool and fun position where I get asked to read other people's books for blurbs. But I do get a lot of them, especially in horror, where they're just, I guess people think there aren't that many horror writers, so I'm usually one of the first people to come up on their list.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it's really hard to get a book to Stephen King and some other horror writers. So, you know, I try to be as accommodating as I can, and I tell people who reach out for blurbs, like, hey, you know, I will take your book, but you have to know, like, either if you don't hear from me, that just means I didn't get to it or I didn't like it. But, you know, please don't ask afterwards kind of thing, you know.
Yeah, stop pestering me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And right. And to be fair, like, no one else has really abused that. Like, everyone's been very professional and understanding about it, except for this one guy who keeps emailing me every few months.
Uh-huh.
Like, have you read, you know, showing me links of things that I've talked about that I've read. Like, he's putting it in my face that I've read someone else's book and not his. So, I don't know. Like, any profession or industry that you work in, you know, most people are pretty cool about things, and then there are others who are not.
Did you ever grovel for a blurb, Paul?
No.
No, okay.
No, definitely never.
Just,
nope.
Just checking. Okay.
Yeah. It wouldn't work anyway.
You know, I hate returning to this one more time, but in this notes from the dog walkers, oh, man. When this dog walker is analyzing the bookmark locations in these books and the location of the book by David Foster Wallace, this was hysterically funny.
Oh, thank you.
As a reader, and the way the books are sorted on the shelves, how do you sort them? Do you alphabetize them? Do you do it by color? How do you do it, Paul?
I sort of do it as described in the story. There's no rhyme or reason. You know, okay. I'm sort of a book slob that way.
Big stack of unread books over here in the corner.
Yeah, no, I definitely need more bookcases. I've got stacks here in my bedroom. I've got, you know, stacks in my office, you know, than the main two bookcases, which are already, you know, are too full of books.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know, I have a hard time getting rid of books, you know, unless it's something like I didn't really like. But if it's a book that I like, then I tend not to get rid of it.
I know the feeling. It's painful for the people who love us, though, Paul.
This is true. I don't know. I'm of an age where I'm still like a sucker for physical media. Like, I'm a big music fan, and it's still very hard for me not to have like a cassette or a CD, as opposed to just this ephemeral, you know, MP3 digital thing that, you know, I can't hold in my hand.
No vinyl? You don't have any of that death metal on vinyl, Paul?
No vinyl, just because it's a line I have to draw. I have too many books and too many DVDs, and I know if I went into vinyl, it would be really expensive, and then I would buy a lot of them. So
okay.
I just try to satisfy myself with my, I don't know, I have like 3,000 songs on my phone directly downloaded. That's enough.
What are the hot bands for you these days? What do you like?
So, I'm, you know, I've I'm still fancy myself sort of like an old punk, and definitely a punk fan. But, you know, I kind of like
Husker Du.
Everything.
There's a guy with a Husker Du shirt in your story.
Oh, absolutely. Husker Du is one of my all-time favorites.
Okay.
Old,
all right.
One of my all-time favorite musicians. I'll say this, though. One of my favorite, to me, one of the cooler things that have happened because of writing is that I've been able to, you know, just as like a fan reaching out to musicians, like I playfully stalk my favorite bands. You know, I've sent books to a lot of bands that I admire, and I've heard back from quite a few of them. And
wow.
So, for example, a band called Clutch, who started off sort of as a hardcore punk band, but then now they're pretty much like a straightforward rock band with a like a Southern Maryland sort of flavor to them. But Clutch have been around forever, and you know, their lyricist, Neil Fallon, is a big I feel like music is such a big influence on my stuff. I've always enjoyed his lyrics, and yeah, I come to find out Neil's a big reader, especially science fiction, but yeah, I reached out and sent him some books, and you know, we've kept in contact, and I've been to a show or two as his guest, and it's been pretty cool.
Nice.
Yeah, because, I mean, I don't know, I'm a frustrated musician at heart. Before I started writing, I tried, you know, playing music and guitar, but I quickly found out I was a better writer than musician.
Mm-hmm. When you're writing, are you listening to music?
Only if I have to, like, drown out like the ambient sounds or if people are talking or something like that. And if I do write to music, it can't have lyrics.
Okay.
It has to be instrumental. So I typically write to movie soundtracks. Yeah, usually creepy stuff, but, you know, sometimes, you know, I have like a set of string quartets of Bela Bartok, although that sounds kind of creepy too. His his music is anxiety. Definitely gives you an anxious feeling. But some of the movies, soundtracks that I listen to all the time, like a go-to one for me is a soundtrack to a movie called Ravenous.
Hmm.
And that movie came out in 1999, and it starred Guy Pearce and a few other fairly well-known actors, and it's sort of like a Wendigo myth movie, you know, set in the 1850s Sierra Nevada. It's a very fun movie.
Oh, don't know it. Well, Paul, it's really been a pleasure talking to you about your work.
Well, thank you, Vic. I really appreciate it. That went really fast.
I think that the last horror writer I had on here of any kind of stature and recognition was Clive Barker, and that's been years ago.
Wow. Oh, Clive is one of the best.
He's a trip, that's for sure. And at the end of the interview, he was here at the station, and his husband said, okay, we got to go. And Clive says, well, I got to sign this guy's book. And then he drew this really elaborate picture in the book. It took him about 15 minutes to draw this picture. And I was like, whoa, I guess you're not in that big of a hurry.
Yeah, no, he's an amazing writer. It's funny, my really quick a Clive Barker story, because I'm a huge fan. I had another writer here at the house stay for a couple of nights because he was doing some signings. And we were up late one night talking about our admiration for Clive's work. Now, my daughter, who's 14 going on 15, you know, she's never seen Clive's artwork, and she draws her own stuff.
Oh.
And I don't know like if it was in the ether or if she was listening, but the next morning she drew this piece, you know, without, I don't know if she was even listening to us, but she drew this piece of a scary figure that looks just like something Clive Barker would draw, to the point where, you know, I posted the picture on Instagram, and like four or five people asked, oh, is that like an original Clive Barker piece?
Oh, wow.
And I was like, no. My daughter just sort of weirdly wrote it when we were talking about him. So maybe Clive is listening.
She was channeling it somehow.
Yeah.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you, Vic.
My guest has been Paul Tremblay. His book is Growing Things and Other Stories for the Book Nook. I'm Vic McCunis.